When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to Katie Piper's Extraordinary People. It's the podcast where I sit down with an extraordinary person and they share their story. They might have overcome something incredible or they might actually still be on their journey, but with stories that will make you laugh, cry and hopefully feel a little bit inspired. Today, a woman who has stayed true to herself and continued to chase her dreams even through times of adversity. Seema Jaswal is a sports presenter rising to the top in a male-dominated industry. After contracting bacterial meningitis at 16 years old, not only was Seema seriously lucky to come through the other end with no lasting after effects, but doctors told her that sport probably saved her life. Fast forward to 2008 and Seema took her first TV job for CBBC's Sports Round and Match of the Day kickabout. Since then, she's presented for a multitude of sports, covering some of the world's most prestigious tournaments. She is currently the female lead co-presenter of ITV's coverage of this summer's Euros. And she's using her platform to speak out about her experience of being an Asian female sports presenter, showing the future females of sport the exciting possibilities ahead of them. So I am so honoured to have her here, remotely here today. Welcome to the podcast, Seema.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for the lovely intro. That was beautiful. I really liked that.
It's incredible. Just so many achievements, but so many barriers that must have been overcome. It feels like such a positive step, you know, everything that you're doing for future generations. I'm guessing at the moment with the Euros, your schedule must be crazy.
Oh, it is. It's absolutely crazy. And I think, well, I can't complain because we had to wait a whole year for this. So we have been so excited about the Euros. When I say we, I mean the whole team and the whole nation as well. But finally to have the Euros having started, and it just has been so brilliant. I mean, the standard of football has been great. I think many people thought that it would be a bit different because obviously the football seasons across the continent, across Europe as well, it's sort of just kind of rolled into the Euros with not much of a break. And we know it's been a very, very different sort of season for the players, but it hasn't stopped it being just as exciting as it would have been. We've had some great matches and yeah, the schedule has been hectic, but I've loved every moment of it. I mean, we've been in studio, I've been pitch side for some of the matches. I've travelled, I went on a plane for the first time last week in ages.
Glorious.
I was in Scotland, went to Glasgow. So that was a nice short flight, but it was just so nice to be in the sky. It was just bizarre after so long. So yeah, it's been busy.
It's so nice to hear it's so joyful, because it's funny, I'm not big into football at all, but I've really found myself just enjoying everything about what the Euros representing. I've loved seeing the coverage of people happy, people together, and just sharing something like-minded that we're all interested in. It's really lovely. I'm going to come back to the Euro because, you know, it is so topical. But what I want to do at the start of this pod is I want to go back to your childhood. Your parents fled Uganda and you were brought up in London. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
So what was childhood like growing up? What was it like for you?
My parents did incredibly well because when they came from Uganda, a lot of Asians actually came at that time during the late 70s. And they were just amazing. I had a lovely upbringing, you know, always out and about, always playing outside with friends. I grew up in a really lovely little cul-de-sac where the neighbours all got on. And I had that real like villagey feel to my upbringing. Always with family and friends and just playing sports. And if I wasn't doing that, where would we be? We'd just always be together, really. It was really nice. Yeah.
You said there about you always playing sport. Who was it that got you into sport and how young were you?
So my my grandparents, actually, my mum's side, my granddad specifically, he was a tennis champion in Uganda, and he was known by everybody there that for being this incredible tennis player. And so the family all sort of started playing racket sports, and that bug for tennis and badminton and all of those sorts of sports, even squash, they all loved racket sports. So when I was born, my parents always used to say to each other, I wonder if she has that tennis gene, I wonder if she can play racket sports. And they took me to my first tennis class at the age of 4. So I literally was like, you know, it's like short tennis, having a bit of fun. But the coaches said that actually I kind of took to it quite naturally, entered a tournament age 6, I think it was, and ended up winning it randomly.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it was, you know, like short tennis indoors with like the spongy, the foam balls.
Yeah.
I just loved it. I just absolutely loved it. So it was something that was with me throughout my childhood. I played tennis quite a lot. But then when I went to school, PE was my favourite subject. I loved playing netball, basketball, tennis, football, dance, you name it, I would be part of it because it was just something that I naturally enjoyed. So yeah, it was always something that I did. Look at me, I've just realised
like
this is like
a pint.
I know. Yeah. I've just realised it's a pint glass. This is recorded as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it's fine. It's after 2 o'clock.
Does it look like a pint? Well, it looks like a pint of vodka. It's actually water, I can confirm.
So you talk about this idyllic childhood, you know, it sounds like you were really supported and encouraged, but there was a difficulty in that you were ever so young. You were 16 when you were struck by bacterial meningitis. Can you tell me about that? You know, how you contracted it and how it affected you? Because at 16, you're still very much a child, really, aren't you? You're still navigating your way through life.
Yeah, 16 years old, you're going through all of these big transitions in life, and you know, you're sort of growing up and then you're making that transition to university. And I remember that particular part of my life was so unbelievably busy because I was doing my A-levels, which I still think are the hardest exams to sit, full stop. But there was a lot going on in life as well where you're trying to make decisions for your next steps. And I remember I was in my first year of my A-levels, and again, completely as I was when I was a child, I was doing dance classes and what else was I doing? Tennis. I was doing lots of sport, and I also was studying PE as an A-level and biology, English, sociology. And so life was really, really busy and full on, especially in that first year. And I was also working in a cafe to save some money because I wanted to go to Mexico on a gap year before university. So I'd sort of got that going on at the side. And I remember going to work that day feeling okay. But then I had this headache that just got progressively worse and worse and worse as the day went on. And me being me, I never really got ill. I'm still that kind of person that's like, no, I'm fine. I don't get ill. And if I do, I'm kind of like, just shake it off, take some paracetamol, get on with it. But that particular headache felt different. And so I worked the whole day and then came home, and I literally sat on the sofa. I was like, Mum, my head is pounding. It's so excruciatingly painful. I don't understand what's wrong. She was really worried. So she said she'd like call the doctor. I was like, no, I think I just need to sleep. I must just have the flu. So anyway, went to bed. Mum came in to check on me, turned on the light, and I was like, Mum, you have to turn that off. It's so bright. And my mum knew straight away that's one of the biggest signs of meningitis. When you can't look at the light, it's really too intense if there's any light on, and headaches is another sign. So she called the doctor straight away, and he came over and unfortunately thought that it was the flu, so gave me paracetamol and said, look, she'll be fine, and then left. But Mum could tell that she stayed with me then, and she could just see that I wasn't right. So she then called the ambulance because I was then starting to feel sick. And again, that's another sign if you start to feel sick. So she called the paramedics. By the time the paramedics came, I actually started falling into a bit, like I was completely out of it. I don't even remember this part. But paramedics came, took me to hospital. I don't remember any of this. And then the next thing I knew, I woke up when they were doing the lumbar puncture, trying to extract the fluid from the spine. But in that period, I'd fallen into a coma for about 8 hours. And so that whole period is completely, I don't remember any of it. My parents obviously have relayed everything to me. And yeah, it was really scary because for the person that was sporty, fit, healthy, doing everything, to suddenly pick up meningitis, which anybody can contract, by the way, was really
worried.
How
does it happen then? You don't know,
I don't know. Anyone can catch it. And it's very, very common amongst sort of young, that age group. 16 to 24 year olds. It's just, you know, it can be bacterial, it can be viral, but it's one of those things that there is, you don't know how you contract it. You just don't know. And there's still a lot of research being done to understanding it a bit more. I now represent Meningitis Now as a charity and have sort of met with a lot of meningitis sufferers and their families since. And I am I'm just so unbelievably lucky to have come through it without any long-lasting effects, because so many people are left either having lost a limb or their sight is impaired, or some people don't make it through. And I've met parents that have lost their children from it, and it's devastating. So, yeah, I was very lucky. The doctors at the time said to me, I mean, there's no fact, but I do strongly believe that when you're fit and healthy in general, it does help. And they said to me, if you weren't as healthy, you probably wouldn't have pulled through it as quickly as you did, because I was eager to just, I just wanted to get out, but I'd lost loads of weight. I was just skin and bones, really, after that whole process. I was in hospital for 2 weeks, came out, and they said that sport was a big part of why I managed to come through it.
Thank goodness your mum, you know, her instinct, she followed her gut, she pushed, she knew something wasn't right with you. Was the recovery like sort of months or years till you were back to feeling like a normal 16-year-old?
It was like 3-4 months, but that was with me just really trying to get myself back to normal, like trying to eat really healthily and just build up my strength, go get back to exercise quite soon. I mean, the main thing was that I was very weak because of all the weight loss. I think my body recovered quicker than most.
So what about your mind? Did it affect your confidence?
I remember at the time, I didn't think it did, but I think that there were times that I did feel really low with the whole thing, because people would come. So I, obviously when you're being 16 years old, I had all my friends at college and they all wanted to come to hospital to see me. But then you had a few people that were still like, oh, can I be around you? Is it all right to be around you? And it was that was really hard. I think people would probably feel like that now with the pandemic, with having COVID. You know, when you have something and people are worried that it could be passed on, which is perfectly, like, which is such a normal reaction. But that was the bit that got to me, where I was totally fine, but certain people afterwards thought, oh, I don't know if I can be around you. And I'm like, no, it's fine now. It's absolutely fine. But their fears made me feel a bit rubbish sometimes, because it just felt horrible. But other than that, I had my support structure around me. I got through it. And then before I knew it, it kind of motivated me, to be honest, to just go out there and save up for my Mexico trip, which was like everything that I wanted to do.
Yeah, it's really interesting when people talk about being affected by a disease or a disability and then suddenly having like labels attached to them or some kind of discrimination because of it. You know, lots of people say it actually motivates them on their, not just their journey of recovery, but their next steps. And I wondered, you know, it is such a male dominated industry, but you know, here you are a woman in your own right. You're very successful in that world. I wondered what that's been like for you. And actually, have you noticed changes over the year for women in that world?
Yeah, I have definitely noticed changes. I think if you'd spoken to the likes of Gabby Logan or Claire Balding, Hazel Irvin, who I get to present the snooker with, who's just amazing, even Kirsty Gallagher, who was presenting at Sky Sports News when I was a runner, all of these women entered the sports world, that sports media world, during a time where there weren't many others. In fact, they were probably the only ones that I remember anyway watching growing up. And now I feel that from the moment I started presenting, so I went after Sky, I went off to India to become the face of Indian football. And there was an opportunity to present all of their live football coverage. There was a new league out there. And from that moment, I mean, the Indian public just embraced me. It's very normal out there for females to front sports. So that wasn't even a thing, that no one even questioned it or made me feel any different. But even when I transitioned back and started presenting the Premier League global coverage, when I go in now, on any given day, I look at a call sheet from morning to evening, and there will be just as many female presenters as there are male presenters. It's actually a lot more balanced. And that's my experience. I don't know if it would have been the same for everyone, and especially a few years back. But even with the snooker that I present, I have female floor managers with me, female producers, directors, PAs in my ear. It's Hazel and myself fronting the coverage. Although we have a lot of male pundits, there aren't many female snooker players in the game. But still, the whole collective team, even behind the scenes, I don't feel like it's so one-sided. as much. Mm. I mean, there are some productions you go on and it is that way. But for me, even with ITV now, you know, I have a female producer that I work with, that I'll be working with on my highlight shows. And yeah, it's just, I'm working with some great female pundits like Enya Luko and Emma Hayes. I think that things have definitely transitioned and are definitely changing.
You may have heard of the podcast Juicy Scoop. Wondered what it is? Why aren't you listening? Well, I'm its host, created it, been doing it for 7 years. I'm Heather McDonald of Juicy Scoop with Heather McDonald. Now, I could tell you why you should be listening to my show, but my listeners wanted to write the ad for me, and here are some of the things they said. Not your regular Juicy podcast. Catch up on all the juicy topics from Hollywood and pop culture to true crime and beyond. Heather McDonald's Juicy Scoop always has great guests, great laughs, and great gossip. It's a comedian's take on the hottest headlines. Juicy Scoop is the pop culture news you want to hear. No BS, no filter, no filler. Raw, real, and in the moment. Throw in the hilarity of amazing comedians that you'll instantly be obsessed with, a juicy crime story, and a dash of normal life in LA moments, and you've got yourself an amazing week of Juicy Scoop. Two episodes every week, every Tuesday and Thursday. It will never let you down.
So for the Euro, Euro 2020, the lineup is 11 presenters and you're one of only three women in that lineup. But from that, I do take, well, actually, families all over the country will, with young daughters like myself, I've got two young girls, will all be watching you and, you know, our girls will be inspired by you. So yeah. Well, that does partly feel hopeful. I mean, how do you feel about
it
that?
It does. I mean, so I'm basically, it's Mark Pugosh and myself that front it. And then you've got Reshma Chowdhury, another presenter, and Michelle Owen. Then you've got Emma Hayes, Enya Luko, Nadia Nadim. So there's a few female pundits, not as many as the men, but there's a lot more than there ever has been. And So the on-screen presence in general has definitely, it's definitely evolved. But of course, there's always more that can be done. And I think this is a great platform. It's a great platform. Yeah. And it does make me feel, I feel quite proud to be part of that generation, because I can only hope that that will inspire more women to follow. And I think it will do, you know, I think it will, because I have a lot of messages that I see in my inbox and via my website, people getting in touch on social media saying that, you know what, you've really inspired my daughter who wants to get into football now. And I get a lot of those messages and it's so heartwarming. It's amazing to see.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you, you know, what could the industry do to get more women into kind of these lead positions, positions of presenting sport? But maybe it's not just the industry. Maybe it's us, the parents as well.
Yeah, I think it's always a collective. I mean, I think with young girls now, I think if they can see more females in those positions, that's only going to inspire them and make them believe that they can get there. So the industry has a responsibility to absolutely have more females on screen. And I think that the broadcasters I've been working with have definitely made that change, definitely made that shift. And what I have noticed as well, I work with just at the Premier League, for example, I work with a lot of male pundits and they all have daughters who are, I mean, not my age, but maybe a bit younger than me. And they understand this importance. So there's sort of encouragement from all angles, which feels really positive. But yeah, I think that it's about that collective understanding. I think also behind the scenes in sport, it'd be nice to see, I think you need diversity and change across the board. So even at decision-making levels, you want to see a bit more balance. You do want to see diversity. So there's still steps that need to be taken, but it's definitely moving in the right direction.
Yeah, I think you're right. And you know, when you were announced to be presenting the Euro, I think a lot of people celebrated the fact that, you know, you're an Asian woman taking the lead role in this, you know, in the sports industry. And I think that was also really fantastic. But I wondered, what is the reality for you of being from an Asian background in this industry? You know, that what are the pros and the cons?
I think being an Asian, like, I'm proud to be doing what I'm doing. I never, growing up, I never really thought of myself as Seema, the Asian woman doing this. I just see myself as me. This is me. This is what I want to do. That part of me is so important. So is the fact that I'm a woman. So is the fact that I'm a daughter. So is the fact that now I'm a wife and I'm a friend and I'm a, you know, or, you know, you wear different hats. There's always different roles. And I think now where I'm at, I look back, and again with all the messages and even family coming in and like saying to me, wow, we are so proud of you, I think I've realized the importance actually of just opening people's eyes to other possibilities. I think people know that the media is a viable option, or if I talk about Asian families, for example, I don't know how many parents encourage their kids to get into media. I know my family, they were very open-minded in saying, look, do what you want to do. But I think the media in general is seen as it's a very, very tough industry and tough world to break into. So because we're so encouraged to go to, you know, to go to university or to be educated, to have something to fall back on just in case it doesn't go right, I think hopefully I'm an example of somebody that actually, if you just work really hard and you keep going at it and keep going and keep going and keep going, it can happen for you. And there's also a lot of different things you can do within the media world. It's not just on screen. There are so many things behind the scenes as well. So I think that with where I'm at now, hopefully that will open the eyes of others.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I was wondering, you know, what would you say to women like you or the younger you who really want to get into the world of sport or sport and television, and maybe they don't have the confidence to go for it? And, you know, I mean, you kind of answered that question there of really actually you don't just have to be an academic, or you don't just have to look a certain way. And I think that misconception can sometimes stop people for going towards something and pursuing it.
Yeah, I think what I would say to the younger me is that if your dreams don't scare you, they're not big enough. And that's what I've always kind of followed from when I was young, from when I've got into this industry. Because I think it's so easy for us to always want to stay in our comfort zone because it's comfortable. And sometimes to stretch yourself or to challenge yourself, it's scary. Of course it's scary, but it's okay to be a bit scared, to be a bit challenged at times. And so that is what I would say. I think also with anything that you want to do, and if you want to be the best at it, and especially in the media world, you know this as well, it's tough because so many people want to do what you do because it's a fun industry. But behind the scenes, you have to put in the hard graft. It's not just about, you know, I don't know how you appear, or it's not just about one thing. It's about multiple things. And I think the biggest thing for me is the preparation and the hard work behind the scenes that prepares you for when you're live on telly broadcasting or presenting a sport to millions around the world. Like you need to know your stuff. And that's what I do always say first and foremost when anybody asks me about this. You know, it has to be something you want to do, but you have to work hard for it as well.
And you're right. I think sometimes people don't necessarily see that, you know, when you think of that analogy of a beautiful iceberg and then what's actually going on below the ocean and how it looks. And I kind of know in my own life, actually, when I've experienced discomfort and life's been difficult is when I've been forced to change. So amongst all of the other things that you've done, when I was researching you, I also saw that you've done some brilliant speeches. You've been to the House of Lords on International Women's Day, the Young Leaders Summit in Manchester. And I thought, well, that's really interesting, because you are, whether it's, you know, by purpose, you are a role model, and you're delivering these talks to young people and impressionable people. And I wanted to know a little bit more about that part of your life and why it's important to you.
I think when I was going through this industry, I was told so many times, you don't know anybody. You don't know anybody in the media world. You don't come from a media background. This is going to be a real struggle, because you're often told that you need to know somebody, or it's all about the network. And networking is really important. It's always good to know the right people. But I went into it knowing nobody, having nobody that knew the boss of somewhere or that had any insight into what the media world was like. So when now I've got to a stage where I've been asked to do these talks and, you know, to do the Manchester City Summit and all of those sort of things, and International Women's Day as well, I think I just feel like, you know what, I really hope that from whatever I've learned along the way, that if I can pass a little bit of it down and it trickles down to the next generation or someone out there and it can help them, then I'm all game for that. I learned as I went along, and I think there's so much you can learn from just going out there and just seeing what happens sometimes. You know, no one writes, there's no rule book. I didn't go the conventional route. I was told at the very beginning that I didn't have a journalism background, because I don't. I'm not a traditional journalist. I don't have that qualification. And I didn't have a media degree. I didn't come through that avenue. I kind of created my own path. So I think I'd like others to just know that whatever it is you want to do, it doesn't even have to be media, it could be anything. You can create your own path. You can. You just have to have a little bit of a plan and an idea of where you're going and have a very good network. I'd say, when I say network, I mean somebody that you trust that will be by your side, that can advise you or tell you when you're going wrong. And you might not know that person now, but as you progress through life, you do find those people. You tend to cross paths with people that then become mentors. So I like the idea of giving back. And the other thing is, as I was getting into the industry, everybody used to say to me, Siva, how do you present? I just freeze when I present. Like if somebody has to do a wedding speech, or like my best friend's partner had to do a speech at a wedding. And so I actually sat with him and helped him to overcome his fears, because people find it really, really scary. And it got me thinking as well, we're not taught how to present ourselves. Nobody's taught. We're not taught this at school, are we? But yet we have spent so much of our lives presenting ourselves, whether it's in a job interview or whether you have to do a speech or a presentation in front of your class. I mean, how many times have we all dreaded it? I remember dreading those things at school, thinking, I don't want to stand up in front of the class. So I developed this from somewhere. I don't know how. It's just as I've gone along, I've just become confident in it and I love what I do and I've worked hard. So if I can pass that down to people, I just feel very happy to do that.
I love what you said there about network and connection, because some people listening to this might think, well, I don't know anyone, I don't have anyone I can rely on. But actually, you should really value every interaction you have, because everyone you meet is there to inspire you, even the negative people, because some people can come into your life to inspire you to be absolutely nothing like them at all. So there's no such thing as a dead connection, you know, so really treasure them all and seek them out for what they are.
I agree. I totally agree. Actually, when I first got into the industry before CBBC, I got my CBBC role through my first agent. And I got my first agent because somebody told me, in WH Smith, you can buy this book called The Book of Contacts.
I remember that.
And it just has every agency contact. So I bought it. I went through it.
Book.
Did you? Well, there you go.
So pens through it.
I highlighted. Okay, that sounds good. That sounds good. And just sent off emails to all of them, one after another. And that
proactive.
And that's how it happened. So
Well, that's another example, isn't it? Of like, if you want something, make it happen, go out there. Don't worry about looking or feeling stupid. Don't worry about the rejection, because if you approach 1,000 people, a handful will reply.
Yeah,
you know?
And in an era of social media where we're quite connected now, you know, you can send someone a message on social media. You can on LinkedIn reach out. You know, there are different ways you can send out. It doesn't have to be like sending your showreel in the post, which I remember doing as well, like making like 10 copies and like posting them out.
Yeah, I remember that. I'm not wanting to send them to like people that may not be worth it, because it's quite expensive to make another copy.
Yeah, I don't want to waste that one. Yeah.
Burn another CD. Oh my God, we sound so old.
I know. I actually feel really old now.
So your career, I mean, it's going to continue to go from strength to strength once the tournament is finished. What is next for you, and what excites you about the future?
Oh, good question. What is next? I don't know what's next, if I'm honest. I think for me, once the Euros finishes, then I have another year left to do all my Premier League coverage and the global coverage that I present. And then I have to just see where life takes me, what other opportunities come about. I mean, the snooker and the football sort of with me now. I don't think that's ever going to go anywhere. But then other opportunities that come about. I mean, I'd love to be at the World Cup, which is in Qatar, and hopefully I'll get to be there. We've actually just bought our first home together. So I'm properly into like renovation mode now. I can't wait for our planning permission to come back so I can just get my teeth stuck in and like paint and just design this house that I just can't wait to move into. So I think after the Euros in the near future, it's going to be house and just spending time with people. I think one thing we've all probably felt during lockdown is we just missed our loved ones so much. And now, as things have started to ease a little bit, work's been so busy, I also haven't been able to see and spend too much time with my close family and friends. So I don't know what it will be, but I'm excited for it.
And actually, that's the beauty, isn't it? We don't have to map our lives out. We don't have to know the next move. We just have to keep believing in ourselves and stay excited about this crazy thing called life.
Yes, exactly.
You know, and never lose. And that's what you feel like to me. You feel like a really optimistic, excitable person. I guess never lose that, because that's so attractive, you know?
Oh, thank you. No, I am. And I think I feel incredibly lucky to do what I do as well. I mean, to be able to, you know, work on things like the Euros and to be part of the Premier League team or the BBC snooker. These things, sometimes I sit back and I'm like, wow, like I know I worked hard for it, but it's just so nice to actually be part of all of that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think I do feel very grateful, especially given the times that we're in as well, to have kept on working throughout it and to have been at Wembley to watch England make it through to the quarterfinals. That was exciting. And I don't know where this is going, but I have a good feeling, Katie. I have a very good feeling.
Well, we're also on the edge of our seats, aren't we? We're all supporting England. Oh. Well, thank you for sharing a part of your life with us. You're inspiring so many, I was going to say so many young women, but you're inspiring lots of men and women at the moment. So thank you. And it's been so lovely to have you on the podcast.
It's been lovely to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Our pleasure. Thanks for listening to Katie Piper's Extraordinary People. If you haven't already, please follow where you get your podcasts. Also, if you enjoyed this, please help us spread the word. Rate and review the show or share on your socials.